Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna on News Talk.
Yes, you can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com or you will find me on Instagram. I'm at Claire McKenna Presents. Coming up this morning, should I be worried is a question many parents of young children ask themselves, and it's also the title of a new book by paediatric consultant Dr. Niamh Lynch, and she'll join me on the show. Ahead of International Epilepsy Day tomorrow, we'll be learning what to do in the event of a seizure. And I travelled to Tipperary recently for a very special screening of a new documentary, A Vision for Vision, looking at the role of nutrition in our health span. So what sort of a health and wellness week did I have? Well, I sort of feel like this week shot by. I did like having the bank holiday thrown in there, so thank you again, St. Bridget. And I've had lots of lovely life events this week, from date nights to celebrating my mother-in-law's 70th birthday in Sligo. So happy birthday to Mary. She is the absolute best and forever young. Everybody always says it. I love Sligo. We were at the Voya Seaweed Baths. We were at Shell's Cafe and Shop, which is run by my old school friend Jane and her husband Miles. And it was just really nice to get away as a family and have the wider family together, all the cousins and in-laws together. Good for the soul, for sure. And my dad's best friend died this week, and I felt I couldn't have the show go without mentioning it, because I always like to talk about the ups and downs of every week. So alongside all the joyous occasions, sometimes you'll have a dip. And he was the epitome of a good man. He was a good friend to my dad since they were kids in each other's houses. And he was such a good friend, obviously, throughout the years. But in the latter stages of my dad's dementia, he still called and took my dad out on days where it would be very challenging to do so. And he was just a friend to him right until the very end. And since my dad died, he has checked in on my mom constantly. So his family and my family are very much interwoven and like family to us now. So it was a really big deal and an end of an era, and reminded me a lot of memories of my dad this week. So as I say, that's life. There are highs, there are lows. So I've been thinking about him a lot this week, and of course, his lovely family. You can email the show aliveandkicking@newstalk.com. Now, epilepsy is a neurological disorder characterised by a tendency to have recurring seizures. International Epilepsy Day takes place tomorrow, February 9th, and I'm joined in studio now by Paddy McGagan, Epilepsy Ireland Advocacy and Communications Manager. Paddy, you're very welcome.
It's great to talk to you, Claire, on the eve of International Epilepsy Day.
There is a lot of fear and stigma still around epilepsy, isn't there? I mean, you know, to witness somebody have a seizure is, of course, it can be a frightening and a challenging situation for people. But at Epilepsy Ireland, you're very keen to educate people, and that then reduces the fear and eradicates stigma, you'd hope.
Of course, yeah. So since 2021, we've been using the keywords of time safe stay to help the public know how to correctly respond to a seizure. And very simply put, it's time the seizure. If it goes over 5 minutes, you need to call an ambulance. It's safe. You need to keep the person safe during their seizure, and stay. You need to stay with them throughout their seizure and then shortly thereafter as they recover. So obviously with timing, as you say, it can be quite distressing in terms of actually witnessing a seizure at times. A second can feel much longer than it actually is. So that's why it's so, so important to actually time it. Because if the seizure goes over 5 minutes, it's deemed a medical emergency and an ambulance needs to be called.
Okay, so if you see something like that, it's advisable to take your phone out and just flick on the timer.
Obviously take that breath and remain calm insofar as possible at the start. In terms of safe, you need to keep the person safe. Now, a lot of your listeners will be familiar with convulsive seizures, which I think is the picture of epilepsy that everyone has, where a person suddenly falls to the ground, their muscles jerk and their body stiffens. So that's a convulsive seizure. Now, in that type of seizure, you need to protect the person's head with something soft. You need to, I suppose, remove anything harmful from around them. So that means if say, we're in a restaurant and there's a chair they might be in danger of hitting off, you move the chair, not the person. And another thing we ask people to be aware of and safe is you do not put anything in a person's mouth during a seizure, and you do not restrain them during a seizure. They are two medical myths when it comes to epilepsy. So don't put anything in their mouth and don't restrain them.
What about the recovery position? I mean, I'm saying it and I'm not even 100% sure of the recovery position, but I believe it's more on your side rather than on your back. But do you leave people to have the seizure without moving them? Because I was conscious you said that, move the chair, not the person.
You can't stop a seizure from happening. If you can put them into the recovery position, yes, do. But it's not a full requirement. Another thing just to touch upon as part of SAFE as well, Claire, I would like to mention, because it is a part of epilepsy people don't realise, there are non-convulsive seizures as well. So people won't be as familiar with those. Now, that is where a person may be, I suppose, staring blankly, zoning out, behaving oddly, for the want of a better word. They may be smacking their lips, they may be pulling at their clothes. And that person can actually be wandering during a seizure as well, could be wandering aimlessly. So you need to keep that person safe as well, because they are not aware of their surroundings because they're in the midst of a seizure. But again, not restraining them or pulling them back or holding them down. You need to gently guide them away from danger. And finally, going back to stay, you need to stay with the person throughout their seizure, and you need to, I suppose, stay with them and reassure them that they're okay, explain what's happened, and that can really make a world of difference to that person as they recovered. So the key words again, time, safe, stay, and more information on epilepsy.ie.
So when you say it goes past 5 minutes, either of those, convulsive or non-convulsive, is it time to call an ambulance? Is it that sort of an emergency?
Yes, of course, yeah. That would be, I suppose, the international norm, you know, to call after 5 minutes. Again, the reason we say time it is because, unfortunately, there is, I suppose, a belief that an ambulance needs to be called for every type of seizure. And that can be really, really challenging for people with epilepsy. It can be bad enough having a seizure in public, but then to have an ambulance and, I suppose, the rigmarole that goes around that, and then, I suppose, people may be insisting that the person needs to wait in an ambulance. That's a huge disruption in their lives. While, of course, we say if a person is in any doubt to call an ambulance, but time, safe, stay is the correct response. And knowing that 5 minute rule is really, really important as well.
So what if it is somebody who has epilepsy and they know they have epilepsy and they come back around and they say, no, look, this can happen from time to time, I'm fine. Mm-hmm. Is that something that's acceptable?
Yes, of course. Yeah, a lot of people with epilepsy now who would engage with our service would actually say that it's one of the kind of more frustrating aspects of living with epilepsy, and that an ambulance may be called every single time. And of course, that's why we want to reinforce the message of time, safe, stay amongst the public, so that people do know that there is that 5 minute rule in terms of when to call an ambulance. We've actually created a song around time, safe, stay. Now, we're making absolutely no apologies about it. We want to get this stuck in your head.
Are you going to sing a few bars for us now?
I don't think the Donegal accent fully lends itself to musical nuances, but I would encourage everyone to visit our website and listen to the song. The whole tagline is listen now, remember later, and that's exactly what we want.
So, Paddy, you won't sing. I think there's many fine singers with a Donegal accent, but we do have a clip of the song that we can play now.
Can we say time, safe, stay? If someone's not okay, we say time, safe, stay. If somebody has a seizure right in front of you, you might feel afraid and not know what to do. Time, safe, stay. But you just take a deep breath, it's gonna be okay. Just remember these three words, time, safe, stay. Yeah, we say time, safe, stay. If someone's not okay, we say time, safe, stay.
And is epilepsy something that can just come on a person later in life? I think there's a misconception that you have to be born with epilepsy.
Yeah, and that is a definite misconception. It's a misconception I personally had before joining Epilepsy Ireland as well. Yeah, epilepsy can be diagnosed at any stage of life. It can come as a result of brain injury. It can come as a result of a stroke. But I suppose the stat I would like to focus on, particularly for your listeners, is that in 50% of cases, there might be no known cause in epilepsy. So epilepsy is unfortunately a condition that may suddenly visit households across the country. That's why it's so, so important to have an understanding of epilepsy. And something just to mention as well is that epilepsy is way more common than people think. There's over 45,000 people living with epilepsy across Ireland, one of the most common neurological conditions in the country. Yet there does seem to be this perception that it's rare. Nothing's further from the truth. It's within your family, it's within your friends, colleagues, workmates, teammates. So that's why it's so important to have a basic level of understanding. And seizure first aid is a huge thing to know for people.
Yeah, so just remind people again, it's time, it's safe, it's stay. So time, the seizure, time what's going on, be it convulsive or not. Yep. Keep the person safe, make sure they can't come to any more physical harm than is necessary during that seizure, and stay with them. But I really took from what you said that if somebody comes around from that seizure and says, look, I'm going to call my partner, my friend, I'm fine, I know what this is, I think we need to respect that with people also.
Of course, yeah. And it can be, if you can imagine how just distressing it can be at times in terms of coming to, not necessarily knowing what happened, but then equally realizing that you've had maybe a breakthrough seizure or had a seizure again. All for people who have an established diagnosis of epilepsy, all they want to probably do is go home, recover. As soon as they get home, the sooner they recover. Yet we have those instances where people are insisting that they stay and wait in an ambulance. You really just have to be guided by the person. Now, recovery can vary from person to person, obviously, and epilepsy so individual that there's no set game plan I can give to you here saying, you know, after 30 seconds, they'll be fine. Other people, it'll be totally different. But, you know, knowing that kind of stay aspect of seizure first aid and knowing to be led by the person is really, really important, we believe.
Yeah, and as you said, it is very individual, but it is a very treatable condition, because I think also when we're saying, you know, it can just arrive out of nowhere, it's sort of giving people fear. But, you know, if it is something, you will be able to get treatment, there's medication, you will be able to get support. But the more the general public, I think, is armed for witnessing a seizure, the less fear there'll be.
Of course, yeah. And for anyone diagnosed with epilepsy, up to 70% of people can become seizure-free if the right treatment for their individual epilepsy is identified. So obviously that's a big number. Most commonly that's through anti-seizure medication. But I suppose, again, hooking back to the individual nature of epilepsy, it can be complex. It can be a massive, long journey in terms of actually becoming seizure-free. And then obviously for 30% of people living with condition, it can be more complex and can have much more of an impact on their lives. So I think for the public, having a basic understanding of epilepsy, knowing how to respond to a seizure, knowing the realities of epilepsy as well, I think is really, really important. Through the lead up to International Epilepsy Day, we've been sharing a series of personal stories of people across Ireland living with the condition. And just taking a moment to read those stories will really bring home to your listeners how epilepsy affects people in different ways, but also dispel the many myths that are out there about the condition as well.
Brilliant. Well, a reminder, it is Time Safe Stay. And for more information, you can go to epilepsy.ie. Epilepsy Ireland Advocacy and Communications Manager, Paddy McGagan. Thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you, Claire.
Right, coming up after the break, I travel to Carrick-on-Shore, the hometown of Professor John Nolan of the Nutrition Research Centre of Ireland, for a very special screening of his documentary, A Vision for Vision. You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, Professor John Nolan has been on the show many times. He's the scientist leading a team at the Nutrition Research Centre in Waterford. I've had him on talking about his groundbreaking research into the power of carotenoids found in colourful foods and their role in eye and brain health as we age. This research and his story, including the development of a carotenoid supplement, travelling from Mexico to France and to Norway to source ingredients, and the family legacy behind the marigold farms, the omega harvesting, and indeed John's patient zero was his mum Helen. So it was only fitting that the very first screening of his documentary telling this story, A Vision for Vision, took place in his hometown of Carrick-on-Shore, which I'm told the locals call Carrick. There I got to meet so many of the community, indeed his mum Helen, and lots of his family, his sister Shirley, at Brewery Lane. And that's where we watched the film for the very first time. So after the screening, I nabbed John to see how he was feeling.
Yeah, I feel grateful. I enjoyed it. I enjoyed it because I saw people I haven't seen in a long time, but I enjoyed seeing their reaction. And I feel that, you know, I'm confident in the science and always have been. But when you put the science into a film, you don't know how people are going to react. And just to looking at the reactions across, it's been just so amazing. And that's really important.
So for those who don't know, can you tell us a little bit about A Vision for Vision and the story you're looking to tell?
Yeah, so Vision for Vision is a film documentary that tries to summarise 2 decades of our work. And as scientists, we always talk to other scientists. Like, we publish a paper, it's reviewed by other scientists. And that's who you're kind of speaking to in those environments. So you're trying to make sure you have the state-of-the-art methodology, that you add to the science, and that's what you care for. But when you do a film like this, it's not for scientists. It's for everybody else, actually. So you have to kind of speak differently, communicate differently. But Claire, I've always felt if you're a good scientist, you can communicate to anyone your message. And that's really what we tried to do here. We tried to make it relatable to everybody, really.
Your mum is in it. She's patient zero. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, ma'am. So it's linked to technology, actually, because my own PhD, we were looking at nutrition and health and profiles of people. And we wanted to measure these things called carotenoids, which are the star of the film. And we got this thing called a fundus camera, which basically means you can look into the back of the eye. And this was great because, like, imagine being able to look into the back of the eye 20 years ago, which is what we did. And we had to just kind of profile the general population. And Mam came down. Of course she did. She was my biggest fan. So she was always going to help me. And then when we looked into the back of the eye, we didn't like what we saw. We saw the starting of a disease called macular degeneration. And so that's why she's called patient zero.
So it tells the story of macular degeneration, people losing their eyesight into later years, and also brain degeneration, two of the biggest fears of people, that they will get Alzheimer's, that they'll lose their sight or they'll lose their mind. And you really want to empower people with this science and with this knowledge that there are certain things that we can do to reduce that, to slow it down or to stop it happening.
Yeah, so the macula is the back of the eye. So if you think of the eye like a camera, and then you have this piece at the back, which is the retina. That's like the film of the camera. And we celebrate aging a lot, rightly so. But unfortunately, as we get old, we have risk of a disease called macular degeneration. That's where the center of the macula gets sick, basically. And it's like the tissue that normally receives light that gives us vision doesn't work anymore. And people in that case lose their central vision. And what we discovered a long time ago is that right there, we actually have these nutrients that you get from eating healthy foods or from taking the right supplement. These nutrients go there. And the best way to explain it is these nutrients are lacking in people who get macular degeneration. So by definition, if you increase them, if you provide them, we know patients respond to them. And actually, their disease doesn't progress at the same rate. That's a statement of scientific fact. And what we've shown in our own work as well, that the vision gets better. So that's for the macular degeneration bit. And, you know, if we all live long enough, Claire, we'll all have macular degeneration. So we have to kind of balance the harmony of nutrition and disease and the stress of life, really. And nutrition is the key to that. Lifestyle and nutrition is the key to that. And what we discovered in kind of the follow-on science is that actually what we're learning about the eye, the retina, this film of the camera, if you like, it's telling us what's going on in the brain. Because the eye is the seeing part of the brain. And actually work from the US, from Liz Johnson, shows us that, you know, patients that have a lack of pigment in their eye have lack in their brain. And then we started to work with patients with Alzheimer's disease. And we saw that these patients were really deficient in these nutrients in their brain. And then working with wonderful doctors like Prof Mulcahy in University Hospital Waterford, we were able to work very carefully and sensitively with patients to see, could we profile their pigments? Could we enhance their pigments? And we were able to really enhance their pigments. And in some patients, in patients that had very early stage Alzheimer's disease, we enhanced their mood and their memory as reported by their primary care. So it's co-management and it's nutrition at centre.
You also tell the story of elite athletes, of e-gamers. I let the film speak for itself, and I really encourage people to go to see it. But this is why you want to make this film. This is a not-for-profit project of yours, and one that you never really saw yourself doing, but you just want to get the news out there.
Yeah, absolutely. We've spoken to scientists for a long time, and now it's time to kind of bring this information to people and doctors and medicine and government. Everyone should see this. That's our goal. We want everyone to see it, judge it for what it is, and then make an informed decision. Thankfully, this is evidence-based, so the informed decision is a safe one.
Well, congratulations on a fantastic night. I was delighted to be any small part of it.
You're a major part of it, as always, Claire. Thank you for everything you do.
I also spoke to the film's director, Wayne Chesler, about his involvement.
I met John Nolan 2017 or 18. I was filming another documentary regarding health, and I interviewed him. You know, I seized an opportunity. He had a lot to say. I wasn't educated yet on really what he was studying. But that quickly changed because I started working a lot more in the health field, specifically towards optometrists and neurologists and doing intellectual property for them, social media for them, and creating content. And then I came across John again. I got really interested in his story, and we met again. It was right before COVID, and I loved the scope of his story. And we started talking about possibly working together. Once we started doing that, I started realizing, as a filmmaker and a storyteller, there's a lot more here that you could put together, a lot of little stories, but give that giant single message. And we started talking about a film, and I really asked him if he wanted to do something like that. And he was interested in it. And I kind of just really became enamored with what he was doing and the scope of it. And I saw the cinematic possibilities for it as a story as opposed to a book. And since I saw that, I pursued it.
And how did you manage the challenge of getting the science across and then still having it as something for the general public?
A lot of conversations with John and distilling it, kind of converting it from what we would say the Petri dish. Stay out of the Petri dish. This is not doctor to doctor. This isn't white papers. It's not abstracts. It's not the world you live in, which is totally necessary and where you live to create and understand and investigate your science, but to deliver it to where it needs to be, to the awareness of the public, because as we realized and I realized, which also was motivational, is that nobody knows about this, and that was a big question. So understanding it and really, you know, rewriting it into a relatable narration was something that was really first and foremost.
And it took you all across the world. Talk to us about the experience of going from Mexico to Norway to, of course, spending time here in Ireland.
So I remember the day in late September 2023 that we were sitting there and it was like, all right, guys, go time. Let's go. We're making a film. All right. That's great. Where are we starting? What are we doing? And we started putting stuff on paper. And Carlos Torres said, well, you know what? You need the marigold fields and you can only get them for 3 days. And that's 3 weeks away. So it was really just run and gun from the beginning in terms of getting to the marigold fields in Mexico where they harvest them. And the reason we had to get down there, they harvest them around, you know, Halloween in the United States, you know, Dios de los Muertos, for the celebration of the marigolds. It's like a 3 or 4 day window to really go down there. So we kind of jump started the production right there. And once we started going, we kind of kept going and, you know, learning along the way and being flexible, we realized that the story was bigger than just marigolds, that it wasn't just John's story, it's an international story. So we wanted to bring in other components and other people that were working on this and not just have it perceived that this is one guy doing it, because that's open to a lot of criticism and it's not accurate. But it was very conscious to kind of go around the world to have an international presence. And that brought us to Norway, where the omega-3s are processed, which is a major component of the supplement. We went to Singapore, where they were working with elite Olympic athletes, following a 9-month study so that we could, in the film, represent efficacy of it from somebody in this instant. We took John as a fish out of water and threw him into an e-game facility, which is like, what am I doing here? But it was so important that he was realizing that even e-game athletes, which is a huge culture, that their eyes are more important sometimes, not more important than anyone, vision's important to everybody, but how it's their tool, you know, it's like, it's a great tool for them. So it was interesting. So we went from New York, we started in Mexico, we went to London, we went to Cambridge, where John basically started his endeavor. We went to Amsterdam, we went to Norway, as I said, we went to Detroit, I think.
Waterford?
Well, I was getting the saving the best for last. We went to Waterford, where he practices, and here at the moment where we're in Carrick screening the film for the first time, which is so fitting, you know, to film. So it was a great journey, and I think it's just something that's starting, and 5 years from now I could see doing, you know, an addendum or part two or whatever it is, because I think he's just realizing that he's at the beginning of something as opposed to, you know, something that's a declarative sentence and here's my period or my punctuation or my exclamation. nah, there's a huge comma, semicolon and colon in this.
Yeah, I love that. And something I really loved from the film was the theme of legacy throughout it. And so many people that you met throughout the film had their parents in it or work the way they work because of their parents. John's mom is in it, and the film is dedicated to your mother. Tell us a little bit about that.
So my mom passed away from Alzheimer's in 2013. And it was something I was very close to because I cared for her almost till the end when you couldn't. But it was very distressing at the time, you know, calling doctors and this and that. But that was then, and, you know, this is now. And when we started with the film, as I said, the first place we stopped was in Mexico at the Marigold Fields. And I met Carlos, and John and I met Jose Torres, who's kind of like the pioneer of this whole carotenoid, using carotenoids for the benefit of not only animals, but for humans. And he told John, that the research never ends, which is, to me, one of my favorite quotes from the film. But getting back to the family is that John became very close with Carlos and his family and Jose, who's the patriarch of all of this. And as it started evolving the film, because a film, you just don't go out there and drive down, you know, a highway and it's a straight road. It zigs and zags, there's flexibility, stories fall apart that you wanted to pursue, stories all of a sudden pop out of the blue, and hopefully you have the wherewithal and flexibility to recognize that this needs to belong in there. And that family dynamic kept on popping up. And then John told me about his mom, and we interviewed him here in Carrick, and I didn't know that till we were here, and he just started talking about his mom, and we're like, all right, let's chase this story now, or turn the chase into a documentation, and turn the chase and the knowledge of this into a pivotal character arc, story arc, which this became. So the story arcs became John and his mom starting out, which was kind of like a, you know, grassroots, and I love that. You know, it's scientists and all this, but everything kind of starts small. Mm-hmm. And then working, you know, being with Helen, John's mom, and it made me kind of think about my mom in terms of, you know, again, the what if that I said earlier. You can't go back in time, but then we end up in Norway, and Leif Gjengibson, he took over his father's fishing business, but his omega-3 business. So it just kept on evolving, that the story, what we set out to do, kept on moving us into this family structure, whether it was son helping mom, father giving to son to keep the business going. It was just a story arc that was so compelling and something to, you know, weave through as a writer. It's like you get these gems and, you know, it tells you how to tell the story, you know, just being out there, which is what I love about the documentary filmmaking process, is you just got to get out there and have access. And that's what this film ended up doing.
Yeah. And knowledge is power. So you have some meetings coming up. Streaming is imminent for tonight. It's just about John being back in the hometown where he's from and showing it to his nearest and dearest.
Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You know, it just fittings. And sometimes I think you always go back. You got to go back to your roots and your origins. Yeah. I think that's the romantic part of any journey. I don't care what you do in life.
So, Never forget where you came from. Well, it's a fantastic film. And it's been a beautiful night. And thank you so much.
A Vision for Vision is a brilliant documentary, which I've no doubt will be making its way to a streaming giant soon. So pun intended, watch this space. And thank you to everyone that I met in Carrick-on-Shore for being so welcoming. And of course, to Professor John Nolan. Right, coming up after the break, Should I Be Worried? It's the title of a new book by paediatric consultant Dr. Niamh Lynch. When do you need to trust your instincts and when do you seek professional advice? You're welcome back to Alive and Kicking. Now, if you're a parent, chances are you've asked yourself this question at 3 a.m. or any time of the day. Should I be worried? From fevers to funny rashes to sleepless nights and scary Google searches, knowing what's normal and what's not can feel overwhelming. Consultant paediatrician Dr. Niamh Lynch has distilled years of experience into a new book designed to calm the panic and boost your confidence. She joins me on the line now to talk about Should I Be Worried? Niamh, you're very welcome.
Thank you very much.
And why is this such a universal question? Is this one you hear over and over? Should I be worried?
I think it's part of parenting, really, isn't it? We all want the very best for our children, and we're very highly attuned to anything that might seem a bit wrong or a bit off. whether that's their health or whether it's any aspect of their life. And certainly I know that from as soon as I learned that I was pregnant with my first child, that question came into my head multiple times. And it's very interesting what I find as well, parenting nowadays, we tend not to have that sort of extended family around us that maybe we used to have 50, 60 years ago. And it can be a little bit of a lonely place as a parent, and you want to get sort of trustworthy advice without constantly having to ring your mom or your auntie or whatever. So a lot of us turn to the internet, and of course then you're only 3 clicks away from absolute disaster. So I think it's becoming an increasingly common question at the back of people's minds.
I know it is interesting when you think of how our ancestors would raise children, and you would have groups of generations together, and you would really lean on the elders in society who had, you know, raised children themselves, and, you know, who had noticed different ailments or, you know, how to treat them. And that's the kind of trust you'd have. And of course, there's lots of us who still very much lean, myself included, on our in-laws, on our parents to help us with our kids. But it would have been a lot more immediate. And what about that instinct that we carry ourselves? How do we have the confidence to believe in that instinct? Often we call it mother's instinct, but I think maybe we should call it parent or caregiver instinct, to know when there's something really wrong with the child we're with 24/7.
Well, I would always say that intuition is expertise. That's my kind of catchphrase. And, you know, as a doctor, I would have what people would say is clinical intuition about a patient. You know, I might look at them and go, oh, you know, I don't like the look of them. How do I know that things are not going right? Well, actually, that comes from years and years of experience and dealing with other children and observing. And parents do that with their own children all the time. So they live with them, you know, almost every hour of every day, and they become experts in their children's behaviors. So I often use the analogy of, I can tell my child's mood by the way they walk around the house, you know. So that's my years of gathering data on how my children walk around the house, depending on what mood they're in. So, you know, if I hear them stomping down the stairs, I'm like, oh God, they're not in a good mood today. Is that instinct or is that knowledge based on years and years of gathering information about them? And I would say it's the latter. So I suppose to call it instinct or something that's intuitive actually minimizes it, because we are the experts in our own children. And that is something that is increasingly, I think, being recognized, thankfully, by the healthcare arena or area. And we certainly give parents expertise a lot more respect now than we would have done even 20 or 30 years ago.
And you mentioned your own kids there. Did you feel a shift in maybe your knowledge or your bandwidth or any change at all from the training you'd had and your work as a paediatrician and then becoming a parent yourself?
I thought it would be easy, you know, to become a parent with all of the knowledge that I had about child health. But of course, there's so much more to parenting than just their health. You know, there's their mental health, there's their development, there's, you know, feeding them, making sure they get enough sleep, clothing them, all of that stuff. There's so much. You kind of become a CEO of your family, you know, when your children arrive, because there's so much more to it than just their physical health. And I think we don't often recognize, or certainly when you're training as a doctor, you know, you're taught to recognize the sort of the physical stuff and how to sort things out practically. But you can't forget, you know, the emotions and the love and the care that come with every child packaged up in their parents. And I suppose once I became a parent myself, I suddenly understood where all these other parents were coming from. You know, when something's wrong with your child, the anxiety of it, the fear of it is just overwhelming. And I guess I got another insight into how parents might feel after becoming a parent myself. So I wouldn't say that paediatricians who don't have children are not brilliant paediatricians, because that's not true, but it probably gave me a little bit of extra depth in terms of my own clinical practice.
So talk to me about your social media and really upping what you were sharing on Instagram and other areas during the pandemic, and how that first came about.
Yeah, so I was on what was then Twitter, which is now X, which I'm obviously not on anymore. And, you know, advocating for children, for health. I remember they weren't able to get shoes. Do you remember that? children weren't able to have their feet fitted for shoes. And I was meeting kids with infections on their feet because they were getting blisters because they were wearing Wellingtons. And, you know, it was a disaster, really. So I was trying to advocate from that point of view. But you'd always get kicked back. There'd always be the kind of, you know, the sort of strange people in the comments and all that. And then a friend of mine said, "Look, Instagram is a much friendlier space if you want to like, communicate with parents and, you know, you might find it good or a good outlet and, you know, a way to sort of advocate in a gentler space." And so I just started a page and immediately I was inundated with parents going, you know, "I can't get an appointment with my GP or I can't get an appointment with public health nurse. I'm so worried about the shape of my child's head or they're not sitting yet. Is this normal? Isn't it, you know, or should I be worried?" Literally. And so I started doing kind of series on, you know, what just sort of developmental milestones to look out for, what red flags of illness to look out for. And the following just kind of exploded. Like within about 2 weeks, I had loads of like thousands of followers and I couldn't believe it. And I was kind of mortified and kind of intrigued. And I just started then making posts and then sort of doing talking to camera, which I was so embarrassed about. And so I felt it was so cringy, but I got over myself and just kept going. And people seemed to really like it. So I just kept doing it. It's become kind of part of my week now where I'd make some videos and put them up online. And it's just worked into my daily routine.
Yeah, I mean, you've got over 300,000 followers now across the various platforms, TikTok now and Instagram. And it is really helpful. And I know people in the medical profession have to be really careful. All say, "I can't give medical advice." You can't really come back in the DMs and give individual advice, obviously, without seeing the patient or the child in question. But to be able to do, as you say, a quick post that can give that information to that person and to many, so that knowledge is power, so that they know when to be worried, when to ask for help, what to look out for and what questions to ask. Like, it is a very powerful medium.
It is, yes, but I suppose it's transient, like everything on social media. You know, what I have up there, once I put it up there, it's not mine anymore, really. You know, Mark Zuckerberg could shut the whole thing down in the morning if he wanted to. And that's really why I wanted to have a book as well. So it's a tangible thing, you know, it's something that it's not going to disappear. You know, if it's on your shelf, it's there. And that, to me, that's sort of an important milestone in terms of sharing information, because you know, the internet has changed a lot, especially with AI now. Like anything that I put up could be taken and manipulated into something different. Do you know what I mean? And that actually, that does worry me. So at least if there's something tangible, you know, you can't manipulate at the printed word as such. To me, that's kind of a reassurance nearly that I actually have put it all together now and the parents can access it and know, like, this is legit. This has been double and triple checked. It's facts. So that's part of my motivation for doing the book.
And it is so, so detailed. I have it in front of me now, a no panic guide to your child's health. You go from, you know, 0 to 5 on into the early years, literally month by month, and then all the different things that might come up, you know, from developmental differences, as you touched on, hospital visits, teething and teeth. So how did you decide what to put in and what not? And what was the process like for you?
So I talked to my friends, actually, and I talked to people who had young kids and I asked them, you know, what would they find valuable? And then I had a look at my Instagram page and, you know, the posts that were sort of successful and, you know, that had a lot of engagement, and kind of made out a framework then for that. And then I went back then to, you know, into my own head, I suppose, and remembering the sort of emotions of what it was like to be a mom in the early days and, you know, kind of what I would have appreciated back then. And I remembered as well the sort of the more austere books that were around, let's say, when I was a new mom. And I just thought people need something a bit more friendly and a bit more accessible. So then I started laying out the chapters and I got completely engrossed, like in the first few months, you know, of life. I got so engrossed in it that I missed my deadline for submission. They were like, where's the book, Liam? And I was like, oh God, I'm still working on like months zero to two, you know. So I put a lot of time and effort into the very start of the book, just so that it would all hang from that and follow from that.
And I do think that is perhaps the scariest time because, you know, we mentioned the instincts and everything that begin to kick in when a baby comes into your care. And I remember a friend of mine saying, it's so funny how you view the world differently. Plug sockets all of a sudden look like potential death traps. You know, you survey for danger at all times. And this urge to keep this child safe and well overrides everything else. And one thing I wanted to ask you about, because I know it's one of the biggest fears, is when a child begins to run a fever, I think that's when parents can really begin to panic. So, you know, when is it time to just perhaps administer, you know, paracetamol or, you know, a Calpol or a Nurofen? And when do you rush to A&E? Because everybody worries about reading it wrong and not getting to the hospital on time. And then I think people also worry about being seen as a terrified, overdramatic new parent. So what's your advice in navigating all of that when it comes to a fever?
So the hard line is that any baby under the age of 3 months with a fever needs to be medically reviewed. And that's because their immune system is immature, so they can become easily overwhelmed by both viral and bacterial infections. So any baby under the age of 3 months with a fever needs to be medically reviewed. And it doesn't matter what time of the day or night that is, you need to get them checked out. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing is like sort of fever red flags. So once the baby gets to over 3 months, of course, then you're kind of bricking it because, you know, you're so conditioned to go and get help. And, you know, it's very hard to be confident then to manage the fever at home once they're a bit older. But you're looking out for other things as well. So fever is just a symptom of an illness. It's not the illness itself. And you're looking for signs of lethargy, poor feeding, decreased wet nappies, excessive vomiting, any sign of a rash, extreme irritability. All of those kind of things would be red flags and signs that you should get help. If your baby's working very hard to breathe, for example, is another thing. And then another sort of red flag that's sort of more long term is if the fever goes on for 5 days or more, then it's more likely to be bacterial than viral and will probably need an antibiotic. So those are the kind of things you're going to start looking out for. And again, the first fever is going to be intimidating and nerve-wracking. But then, unfortunately, your child is going to have, on average, one infection every month for the first 3 or 4 years of their life anyway, as they encounter various bugs for the first time. So you will, unfortunately, you will actually get quite used to fevers. But it's just knowing how to handle them and knowing when you need to go and get help. And that's quite empowering. Then you say, OK, well, look, these are the red lines and the red flags. And if I'm starting to see them, at least I know that I can go and advocate for my child.
Yeah, because sometimes you can have conflicting advice, perhaps on Google or something that will scare you into taking perhaps the wrong action or just panicking at a time when you really need to stay calm. You have a great no-nonsense way about you, Niamh, that I really liked looking through some of your videos. The one I watched last night, or one of them, was about visitors coming to a house with a new baby. And that's been quite topical lately. Something I think in this generation that perhaps we didn't consider saying was, you know, please don't hold the newborn or please don't kiss the newborn. And obviously that can upset certain camps. But I loved what you said. You sort of said, look, visitors can come in if they're going to help you, if they're going to make you a cup of tea or watch the baby while you have a shower. But if they're going to come in and sit and expect to be handed those things, we'll keep those kind of visitors away. I really like that style that you have. How do you make sure the language that you use really empowers parents? It's medical jargon that they can understand, but also that you're, you know, not getting lambasted in the DMs as well.
That's a fine line. I think I've learned that over the last 4 years. You know, you get it wrong sometimes too. Like I've posted videos that have upset people where I obviously haven't meant to, or frightened people, and I obviously never meant to do that either. Sometimes sharing a very blunt fact can actually terrify people, and that's obviously never been my intention. So I would take that as, you know, if the comments are annoyed and angry, I'd sit back and I go, oh God, maybe I could have done that a bit differently or a bit better. And you learn then for the next time, you know. So, but I suppose the visitor thing, It's something parents are kind of told now in antenatal classes and stuff like that. No visitors, you know, nobody should be coming into the house. And that's very much like my kids at school, you know, where they're being told you have to do your homework, you have to do hours and hours of study. That's basically for the kids who are only half paying attention and who mightn't stick to the rules, whereas the people who are very sort of rule following will follow it to the letter. And when some parents then will hear that and say, I can't have any visitors because I've been told I shouldn't have any visitors. And that could be harmful as well. It's very important for parental mental health that they can have contact with the outside world. And the intention isn't for people to hermetically seal themselves away in the first, you know, 5 or 6 weeks of a baby's life. That's not healthy either. So it's all about getting the right balance.
Yeah, 100%. Well, look, as they say, it takes a village, and I recommend you get Dr. Niamh Lynch in yours. You can follow her on Instagram at Dr. Niamh_Lynch. The book, Should I Be Worried? A No Panic Guide to Your Child's Health. Dr. Niamh Lynch, thank you so much for coming on.
Thank you.
So that's it for Live and Kicking for this week. My thanks to my producer, Marais O'Sullivan, to Hugo De Silva Scott, who was on sound, and to Rory Galvin, who was on podcasts. Thank you to all my guests, and thanks to you for listening. I will see you next week.
Alive and Kicking with Claire McKenna. Sunday morning at 8 on News Talk. Conversation that counts.